How's everybody doing? Happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you. One second, get my computer situated. Hi, Tzvi. Thank you. You too.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
Is it legal to ask you a shiloh before you get started?
Sure.
Why is it we put the oil or the candle in the right first, but we always light the new one first?
I mean, the idea of lighting the new one first is you always want to be turning to the right. In the Beis HaMikdash, they always made right turns because right is considered the more dominant side. So you always want to do mitzvahs heading towards the right. Why you put in the right one first, I think is just because the new candle should be towards the left, I think is the idea. So that then you can turn right. I think it all ties together.
Okay, thank you.
But you know, in the Beis HaMikdash, interesting, the Kohanim would only make right turns. They wouldn't make left turns. So imagine walking around. You know, they have these mazes sometimes you can go to, or it's a right turn maze. Have you ever seen those before? Like at, you know, carnivals and things, where you have to get to the end by only making right turns, never making a left turn. So the Kohanim used to do that in the Beis HaMikdash, and we always try to move towards the right. So that's just the, I think that's where that concept comes from.
So does that mean that somebody who's left-handed couldn't serve as a Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash?
So I don't remember if the lacha is that someone lefty is disqualified. Often we say that if you're a lefty, basically your left is like the right hand, meaning the idea is that it's the more dominant side. So since most people are righties, when it comes down to just a standard, you know, halacha, the right's considered the more significant side. But for somebody who's a lefty, for them, their left becomes like their right. That's how halacha views it.
That's why my brother always gets chadba this time of year, because he's a lefty.
Because on the left side, right. Yeah, but when they ask me to do Hagba this time of year, I used to tell them no, because I'm a righty. Right. Very good.
Okay, thank you, Rabbi.
No problem. So let's speak about Hanukkah. Another week of Hanukkah. We still have a few more days left to go. So I want to maybe share another insight about Hanukkah. I'm going to mute everybody, but as I always say, if you'd like to ask a question, feel free to unmute or raise your hand or do any other means you have in Zoom to chime in. Okay, so it's always amazing to me to see how when it comes to a Yom Tov, that you think after years of studying Yom Tov, like you've seen everything, like all the ideas, you've encompassed it all. There's always something new. You know, the more you learn, the more you see there's new ideas and concepts about a Yom Tov, and it always can add in a new angle, a new depth to what you're trying to accomplish over the Yom Tov. So Hanukkah is no different. You know, Hanukkah, we can learn about it and speak about it for years. And every year we think, okay, I know all the ideas. Nothing new is going to come up this year. And then as you study, new things come up. And the truth is that sometimes you see that different holidays connect to one another, even when you think there's no connection. Often we would say, well, Hanukkah and Purim probably connect. You know, those are both rabbinic holidays. They both seem to celebrate victories we had in times of exile. So Hanukkah and Purim connect. And that's something that I think is more apparent. There's a connection between Hanukkah and Sukkot, which is less apparent, but it's something which has more sources to it. The Gemara makes a reference to the connection of Hanukkah and Sukkot. If you look at the Sefer HaMakkabim, which is not a holy work, it's more of a historic work, the Book of Maccabees, but it also does connect Hanukkah to Sukkot. We do find in Midrashim that the Greeks made a decree that we couldn't observe Sukkot. So there is a connection there as well. There's another connection that I found this year I never actually thought about before. But this year, as I was studying more about Hanukkah, I found this connection. I thought it was very fascinating. And let me give a little bit of history and background to this connection. So it really dates back to the history of the date of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is on Chaf Hei Kislev, the 25th day of Kislev. And the question always is, you know, what's the significance of that day? What was that day exactly? I mean, every Yom Tov we celebrate, the date has a significance to it. So in times of Hanukkah, that day was the day where they entered the Beis HaMikdash, they found the hidden jar of oil, and they lit the fire. But what was the original Hanukkah? Like, what historically, was there something happened on that day which could connect to the miracle of Hanukkah? So let's go through a little bit of the history of the Jews in the desert. And we're actually going to see that Hanukkah had a significant role in the desert when the Jews left Mitzrayim. So we know the Jews left Mitzrayim on Pesach in the month of Nisan. That's a well-known date that's clear in the Torah. They traveled for 49 days, and they received the Torah on the 50th day at Har Sinai, which is the holiday of Shavuos. So we're now in the month of Sivan, 50 days after the Exodus. We know at that point, Hashem spoke to all the Jews. He spoke out the Aseret Dibros, Ten Commandments, and then he commanded Moshe to come up the mountain to receive the tablets. So Moshe ascends up the mountain, right after Shavuos, basically, right after Hashem speaks at Har Sinai. Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain on the 17th of Tammuz, which was the day of the sin of the golden calf, the Cheta Egel. Moshe Rabbeinu came down. He saw the Jews worshiping the Egel Azov, the golden calf. He broke the tablets, and that became a fast day, the Shavuos of Tammuz, and that was a tragic day for Klal Yisrael. After Shavuos of Tammuz, so Hashem wanted to punish Klal Yisrael. We know at that point Hashem removed the divine presence from the Jews. He removed the clouds of glory from around them. And there was a distance made between Klal Yisrael and Hashem, sort of a fallout, as it were. The tablets, the luchos, are broken, and Moshe Rabbeinu has to daven for mercy from Hashem to save us. So that occurred beginning on the 17th of Tammuz, the day of the Cheta Egel. And Moshe Rabbeinu, Rashi explains, based on the words of Chazal, Moshe Rabbeinu ascended back up the mountain on the 19th of Tammuz, 2 days later, to daven on behalf of Klal Yisrael. So we've now moved from Nisan to Sivan to Tammuz, and now, 2 days after the breaking of the Luchos, Moshe Rabbeinu goes up the mountain again, and he prays for 40 days on the mountain that Hashem should spare and show mercy to Klal Yisrael. So 40 days later takes us to right before Rosh Chodesh Elul, the first year of the Jews in the desert. So we're at the end of Av. Moshe Rabbeinu comes down, and then Hashem calls him back up again on Rosh Chodesh Elul. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes down right before Rosh Chodesh, I think it was the 29th of Av, and then he's down for a day, and he's called back up again onto the mountain on the first day of Elul. What happens then with the final 40 days? So these last 40 days is when Moshe received the second set of tablets. So Moshe Rabbeinu is davening and pleading with Hashem during that middle 40-day period, was accepted by Hashem. Hashem decided to forgive the Jews. He recalls Moshe back up the mountain and gives him the second set of tablets. He comes back down from the mountain on Yud Tishrei, Yom Kippur. So 40 days after Rosh Chodesh Elul, 40 more days of being on the mountain with Hashem, receiving the second tablets, Moshe comes down on Yom Kippur, and the Jews receive the second tablets on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a day of tremendous simcha for the Jews because they know that Hashem has forgiven them. Hashem utters the famous word, Salachti kidvarecha, I've forgiven you based on your word. We're forgiven at that point for the Cheta Egel, for the sin of the golden calf, and we have in our hands the second set of luchos, which are a sign of Hashem's forgiveness. So that occurs on the very first Yom Kippur in the desert. At that point, after Yom Kippur, Hashem gives them the command to build the Mishkan. The Mishkan is referred to in the Pasuk as Mishkan Eidus, the Mishkan of testimony. And commentaries are bothered by what's the Eidus, what testimony is the Mishkan giving to us? What's it testifying about? So Rashi says the Mishkan is testifying about the fact that Hashem forgave us for the Cheta Egel. Rashi says, Eidus l'Yisrael shevitar Hashem al Maisa Egel. It's an Eidus, it's a testimony that Hashem has overlooked or forgiven us for the Egel Azav. And how we see that? Because Hashem restored the Shekhinah to Klal Yisrael. The divine presence rests upon the Mishkan. It was something that was visible and palpable. And that was a clear sign that Hashem has forgiven us for the Cheta Egel and has created that relationship. So the we had broken the relationship by the Cheta Egel. There was a distance. There was a falling out, as we said. And then Hashem reacquaints himself with us. He reconnects. He restores the relationship with the building of the Mishkan, and he brings back down the Shekhinah to show us that he is willing to form the relationship once again. And the Mishkan becomes a sign for us of Hashem's forgiveness of the golden calf and becomes a physical place of testimony of Hashem's connection to Klal Yisrael. I see a hand raised. Is that a purpose or a mistake? Serena, I think your hand is raised.
Hi there. I apologize because you explained this, but I didn't catch it. He came down on Shvasarba Tamuz and went back up on Shasrei Tamuz 2 days later.
Right.
But that, for what? But then I thought he went up on Elul, first of Elul.
So he was up there three times for 40 days. The first 40 days was the original Luchos. Then he came down on the 17th Tammuz. The second 40 days was just daven for Hashem's forgiveness, for mercy.
And then
he came down.
I see.
And then the third time was to receive the second Luchos.
Got it. I didn't know about that second time in the middle. When did he come down from the second time when he was davening?
I think it was Chavtes Av.
So he was actually davening like directly with Hashem. In his, but right, it wasn't 40 days. That was less 40 than days. 40 days. It was another 40 days.
Another 40 days,
yeah. Oh, right.
You're 19th right. of Tammuz to 29th of Av. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I didn't know about that one. Thank you.
Sure, no problem. Okay, so we have here the so now we're at the point of the Jews building the Mishkan. So they're giving that command right after Yom Kippur, and they build the Mishkan. The question is, when was the Mishkan completed? So we know that they only actually constructed the Mishkan in the month of Nisan, basically a full year following Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus. They built the Mishkan. When was the work completed? So the Medrash tells us that the work of the Mishkan was completed actually on Chaf Hei Kislev, on the 25th Kislev, the date the Hanukkah would eventually occur centuries later. That's when it's completed. But they didn't actually construct the Mishkan. I mean, all the parts were completed, but they didn't construct it until Nisan. And why is that? So the Medrash tells us that Hashem told Moshe to wait. Why? Because even though it was ready to be built on Chaf Hei Kislev, Hashem wanted to have the Mishkan built in the same month of Yitzchak Avinu's birth, which was Nisan. What's that connection? A different discussion for another time. But the Medrash says that Hashem wanted to delay the construction of the Mishkan until Nisan, because that was the month of Yitzchak Avinu's birth, and that was the right time to build the Mishkan. But Chaf Hei Kislev is now upset. Kislev could have been the month of the dedication of the Mishkan, and it gets pushed aside for Nisan. And we stall. We wait another 3 months to construct the Mishkan. So Hashem said, don't worry, Kislev. You're going to get your fair share. Why? Because when we dedicate the second Beis HaMikdash in the times of Hanukkah, you'll be the month. So even though you've lost the dedication of the Mishkan, that's not going to occur in your month, in Kislev. We're going to have a dedication in a different month, which is the... in a different time, which is the dedication of Bayis Sheni, the second Beis HaMikdash, in the times of the Chashmonaim, during the Hanukkah story, many centuries later. So that's the Medrash says. So it's a very interesting thing. Kislev was actually set aside to be the time of this renewal of the relationship. I mean, if the Mishkan is meant to be the testimony that Hashem has forgiven us, and he's reconnected with us, and he's renewed the relationship between himself and the Jewish people, that was the time that was meant to be. Hashem said, no, what's the way till Nisan? But Kislev was the right time for it, technically. The Mishkan was completed then, and that testimony would have been given in Mishkan. In Kislev. So Hashem says, don't worry, you'll get your chance in Second Temple times. You'll get the chance to be a dedication, and you'll have your opportunity. But if we look at it from a different perspective, if the Mishkan is meant to be a symbol of that renewed relationship between us and Hashem, and Kislev is upset and wants to be compensated for its loss, we have to compensate with the same exact thing. Meaning, giving it the consolation prize is not good enough. Kislev needs to be repaid with a similar idea, or the same idea, as it should have stood for centuries back. So just like the building of the Mishkan, which actually occurred in the month of Nisan, was meant to be a symbol of the forgiveness of Hashem towards Klal Yisrael, and a symbol of the fact that the relationship of Hashem towards the Jews never ends, and the Shekhinah sticks with us even after the tough time, as long as we commit ourselves back to Hashem once again. Just like by the Cheda Egel, we distance ourselves from Hashem, we sinned, there's a fallout, and then we reconnected again. So too, when it comes to Hanukkah, the same idea should apply, because Kislev is meant to have its fair share through Hanukkah. So just like the Mishkan is the testimony to the Shekhinah resting in Klal Yisrael and being restored to Klal Yisrael even after a terrible separation, so too is Hanukkah. Now, what's that symbol of Hanukkah? It's the menorah. The menorah, the Gemara tells us, the same exact idea about. It's an amazing thing. The Gemara says the menorah is edusi, it's testimony, the same wording, it's testimony to the whole world, she'ashchina shor b'Yisrael, that the divine presence dwells in Klal Yisrael. So the same way the Mishkan is Mishkan edus, the menorah is also edus. It's the same idea. So we have the Hanukkah fulfilling that role of being the testimony to Hashem's presence in Klal Yisrael, the same way the Mishkan filled that role. But let's take it a step further, because I think the connection is even more powerful. On Hanukkah, the laning we lay in out of the Torah, the Torah reading on Hanukkah is the Torah reading about the dedication of the Mishkan. So what should have been on Hanukkah in the original times, it happened in Nisan, we laid about that, because Hanukkah is really just a continuation of that same idea. The dedication of the Mishkan, which occurred thousands of years before Hanukkah, that same concept carries on until the times of Hanukkah. Hanukkah becomes the day it's meant to be, but it's delayed. It stalled for centuries later. So giving Hanukkah a dedication of the Second Temple wasn't just a consolation prize. It wasn't just symbolically giving it something else. It's actually giving it the same exact thing it was meant to have back in the Mishkan times, the same exact idea. Now there's a reference to this idea of Hanukkah being connected to the Chet Egel, to the golden calf. Based on a medrash we actually discussed last week. Let's just review it for a moment. Last week we discussed the medrash which says that the Greeks made a decree against the Jews that they had to write on the horns of their ox, leave no portion of the God of Israel. So commentaries discuss, why is it the horn of the ox? So last week we gave one interpretation. That is last week's discussion. But for this week's discussion, we'll give another interpretation. Commentaries say that the horn of the ox actually is a reference to the golden calf. You know, an ox is an adult calf. And writing on the horn of the ox was the Greeks impressing upon us that just like in the times of the golden calf, Hashem put you at a distance and you lost your relationship with Hashem. And yet at that point, you had no connection. So too now, you have no connection. And they're trying to make us think, like they said, in lechem chil b'kei Yisrael, you have no portion in the God of Israel. So they were trying to, they came and they invoked the name of the golden calf. And why they do that? Because it was the same exact point. They were trying to say that you're still at a distance. Don't think God is with you. Don't think the divine presence rests amongst the Jews now. Just like you lost it in the times of the golden calf, you've lost it now as well. You can't connect to God directly. You have to have, you know, God distances you. And that was the message the Greeks tried to impress upon us. There's a distance between us and God. There's nothing special about the Jewish people. We're not special. We're not connected. We have no special relationship. And they're trying to make that, to make us understand, they're trying to impress that upon us. And they said the following, just like the Jews before the times of the golden calf, they were connected to God and they were distant subsequently. So too now. But we know that that wasn't permanent. We know that Yom Kippur stood for us as a testimony. Moshe came down with the new tablets, Luchos Shnios, which told us that Hashem forgave us, and the relationship is still there. So we know this is not true, but the Greeks tried to make us think this is true, and they made us write upon our ox, which is the reference to the golden calf, that God has no connection with you. So let's take this maybe one step further for a moment. The actual sin of the golden calf was a sin of idolatry. Idolatry is that there is another reality that one is supposed to be loyal to. There's something else you can focus yourself on besides God. There's God, and there's other gods, other powers that you could focus on that could be a reality in your life. The challenge that the Greeks gave us is a similar challenge. Now, the challenge there wasn't idolatry. Now, the commentaries describe the challenge of the Greeks was Greek culture. But beyond Greek culture, assimilation, you know, seeping into the Jewish people, it was presenting to us the reality of science, of human accomplishment, as an alternative to God. Now, we don't see it as an alternative. We see it as you can incorporate science within the service of God. But yet, the Greeks said, no, it's not something to incorporate within your service of God. It can stand alone. It's something which could replace God. You don't need God because you can explain everything through science. What do you need God for? You can do it all yourself. Human beings are powerful. Human beings are able to use the world, harness the powers of the world, analyze the world, interpret the world. And what do you need God for? God can stay up in the heavens, and you can have the world down here. So the presentation of the Greeks, of what we call Chachmas Yaman, in Greek wisdom, which is presented as an alternative reality for us to live our lives by, was very similar to the Cheta Egel, because the Cheta Egel itself was another reality to focus on other than God. The Greeks tried to bring us to this recognition that we don't need God, distance God from yourself, forget about God, you have no portion in God, because you have human beings, you have your mind, you have science, you have philosophy. So you don't. What's God for? What's the purpose of God? You don't need it. By the sin of the golden calf, you find the same reaction as we find in the Hanukkah story. What happened? The Jews worshiped the golden calf. Moshe Rabbeinu came down and he said the famous words, "Mi LaShem Eli, who is to God to come to me?" And it says, "Who heeded that call? The whole tribe of Levi." And what happened in the Hanukkah story? We have a very similar source to say that the Hashmonaim, who are all Kohanim from the tribe of Levi, they gather together and they said, "Mi LaShem Eli, if you stand for God, come gather amongst us." And they fought against the Greeks. So the same call that Moshe Rabbeinu made after the Cheta Egel, we have made in the times of Hanukkah. And the same people that heeded the call in the times of the Cheta Egel, the Levium, heeded the call again in the times of Hanukkah. It's an amazing parallel. What then happened? Just like in the times of the Cheta Egel, the Levites rose up and they fought against those that veered away from God, even if it was a relative, even a friend. They had to fight against fellow Jews. So to Hanukkah's times, we had the Messiah, we had the Jews who became Hellenists, that we had to fight against as well. And the miracle of Hanukkah came about through the hands of the Kohanim, the Levium, the tribe of Levi, just like we find that the revenge against those who worship the Egel came about through the tribe of Levi as well. So it's a fascinating thing. The Kohen Gadol, just like he played the role on Yom Kippur of bringing atonement to the Jews, it was the Kohen Gadol's family that were the heroes of the Hanukkah story. So Yom Kippur was the day where that atonement was brought to the Jews, and Hashem forgave us for the Cheta Egel, and we find that to be in the hands of the Kohen Gadol. So too, the Hanukkah story is in the hands of the family, like we say in Al Nisim, B'Mitzvah B'Yochanan Kohen Gadol. It was the times of Matisyahu, who was the son of Yochanan the Kohen Gadol. It was the Kohen Gadol's family that brought about the victory of Hanukkah. So the parallels, there are a lot of parallels here between the story of the Jews in the Midbar, worshiping the Cheta Egel, and the story of Hanukkah. The Cheta Egel was forgiven based on the 13 Midos HaRachamim, Hashem's 13 attributes of mercy. As we say in Yom Kippur, over and over and over again, Hashem, Hashem, Karachim, Lechanun, etc., that forgiveness, that formula was introduced after the Cheta Egel, and the forgiveness came back through that great mercy of Hashem, the Rachamim. We call it Yigil Midos HaRachamim. On Hanukkah, in Al Nisim, we state the following words. We say, V'yata barachamecha harabim, Hashem, in your great mercy. And commentaries say that actually is a reference to these 13 attributes, because the same attributes of Hashem that brought about forgiveness after the Cheta Egel, those same attributes are brought about the Hanukkah miracle as well. We know that on Yom Kippur, which is the day of this forgiveness for the Cheta Egel, it's the day where every single Jew is enveloped in the forgiveness. In Shul, at Kol Nidre, we have a line, we say, that we allow all the sinners to come into Shul. And every single Jew is able to take in the mercy of Yom Kippur. So to me, Hanukkah is a similar idea. What Jew out there that doesn't recognize Hanukkah? No, every Jew, no matter how distant they are, seems to recognize Hanukkah, for whatever reason it is, but they do. And there's a famous idea that's quoted from the Chidushi Arim. It's an idea, Chassidus Shavur, as they would call it, but it's an idea that he brings, which we see the reality of around us. The halacha is that on Shabbos, for Shabbos candles, there's limitation of what you can light. You can't light every single wick, every single oil. There's rules about what you can light, what you can't light. Usually it's not so relevant to us because we have either our wax candles or just oil and wicks and we're fine. But there's many, many halachos about which oil and wicks are allowed to be used for Ner Shabbos. When it comes to Ner Hanukkah, it says you can light anything you want. Even those wicks and oils that are disqualified for Shabbos use could be lit for Hanukkah use. So the Chidushi Arim, the Gera Rebbe, he would say that even though a soul is not ignited by Shabbos, it is ignited on Hanukkah. even those wicks and oils, which can't be ignited on Shabbos, could be ignited on Hanukkah, which means that even the souls of Jews, the Shabbos doesn't reach and don't connect to Shabbos, they still connect to Hanukkah. So just like Yom Kippur is a day where every single Jew is invited in, every single Jew is encompassed in that forgiveness and in that holiness, so to Hanukkah is a day as well where every single Jew seems to connect to Hanukkah. And every Jew is inspired and feels the warmth of Hanukkah no matter how distant they've gone. So Yom Kippur brought about the original restoration of the Shekhinah to Klal Yisrael post the sin of the Chetah Egel. And Hanukkah goes even further, though. Why? Because Yom Kippur brings it about only in the Mishkan. There was a sin, there was a distance, Hashem reconnected with us, and he dwelled back into the Mishkan. So you have the Mishkan, and Hashem Shekhinah dwells in the Mishkan. Hanukkah goes much further, because Hanukkah brings the Shekhinah, brings this testimony of Hashem's divine presence, not only to the Mishkan, not only to the Mikdash, not only to a shul, but to our homes. And it goes much, much further. The Jewish home is a place where God dwells as well. Yom Kippur only tells us about God dwelling in the Mishkan, or maybe in the shul, in the Beis HaMikdash. But Hanukkah takes it much further and says, no, Hashem dwells in every Jewish home. We have a mitzvah, Ner Ish Yubeso, that the mitzvah is upon the household, because the Jewish household is a place where God's presence dwells. So Hanukkah actually takes this same message and takes it further. And it shows the divine connection, the connection we have between us and Hashem, is not only something that's reserved for Yerushalayim, or for the Beis HaMikdash, or for a shul, or for a Beis Medrash. It's there in every single Jewish home, even in the most far-flung places in Golos, in the exile, Hashem Shekhinah is still there, every single Jew. The Greeks told us, right down on the horn of the ox, that you have no portion of the God of Israel, and we respond and we say, no, we have a portion. And that portion is something which is everywhere. It's deep, it's real, and links to us no matter where we are, what time we are historically, where we are on the map, that connection is always there. So this idea of the Shekhinah dwelling in the Jewish home goes right up against the message that the Greeks were trying to impress upon us in the other direction. So the 8 days of Hanukkah really reveal to us that even in the times of Golos, where Jews are at a distance and Jews have sinned, and we have taken on our lives maybe other forms, other lifestyles that are not in line with the Torah, as long as we devote ourselves back to Hashem, we rise up with dedication, self-sacrifice, Hashem accepts us back and comes back to us once again. It's not only in the Beis HaMikdash, it's everywhere. It's not only in Eretz Yisrael, it's all over the world, but it's this testimony that the Shekhinah dwells in Klal Yisrael, and that's the testimony of Hanukkah. The light of Hanukkah really knows no bounds. The light of Hanukkah extends everywhere. The Eidus, this testimony of Hashras HaShekhinah, the Shekhinah dwelling upon us, is not only limited to one place, it's all over. So if we were to, and to summarize, I guess, the parallel of Yom Kippur and Hanukkah is the following. Both are days where Hashem tells us that I can forgive you for the distance you've created, I can forgive you for sins, and I'm willing to bring back my presence into your life. Yom Kippur, it came originally through the second tablets, the Luchos Shniyos. It came through the command to build the Mishkan, and the Mishkan served as that testimony. On Hanukkah, we also became very distant. The Hanukkah is a Yom Tov where the Jews did have, it was a very difficult time for Klal Yisrael. Many, many Jews assimilated. Many, many Jews were very much disconnected from Hashem. Unaffiliated, they didn't feel any connection to the Torah or to Hashem himself. And Hashem said, well, if a group of Jews rises up and dedicate themselves with self-sacrifice for the cause, I'm going to forgive them, and I'm going to bring back my Shekhinah. Hashem makes a miracle with the menorah, and that miracle, we've mentioned before, it wasn't necessary in terms of our survival. As long as we overcame the Greeks, we could survive. But the miracle was meant to be a testimony that Hashem is saying, not only am I allowing you to survive, I connect with you. There's a relationship here. Hashem could have had us win the war, drive out the Greeks from Eretz Yisrael, and allow us to observe Torah once again, without doing the miracle of the oil at all. That wasn't necessary. But that would only tell us that I'm here to help you survive. I'm doing my minimal that I need to do to give Klal Yisrael their existence. But that doesn't show anything about our relationship. That doesn't show anything about Hashem being with us and helping us through difficult times. when Hashem did the miracle of the oil in the Beis HaMikdash and it burned for 8 days, Hashem was saying, not only am I here to help you survive, I'm here to connect with you. There's a relationship which I care about. I'm here to connect with you on a personal level. And this miracle is meant to show that. So it's the Eidos, it's the testimony that not only does Hashem help the Jews survive, but it's testimony that the Shekhinah, the divine presence, dwells amongst the Jews. And that's really the message of Hanukkah. The message, the big message of Hanukkah really is that Hashem is with us and our relationship is there no matter what. I've mentioned before, and I think it's always important to dwell upon it, Hanukkah is the one holiday which occurred post Tanakh times. Right? And Purim's in the Tanakh, Hanukkah is not in the Tanakh. Hanukkah was established post-prophecy, post-Nevuah. Hanukkah is a mitzvah to be done in the cold days of the winter, in the darkness of the night. It's a yontif that represents, as far as we've gone, as distant as things that have been from the ideals that we stand for, despite that Hashem is with us. And the candles burning in the Beis HaMikdash are Hashem telling us, I'm with you no matter what. And the candles burning in our homes are to tell us that same thing. As we light our candles in our homes tonight and the next few nights, we should be thinking how even right now, in a long exile that's had lots of difficulties for the Jewish people, in a very difficult year for all of us, it's been a difficult year for every single one of us, Hashem is still with us. And that's the and that's a message we should take with us through Hanukkah and after Hanukkah. Any questions?
Very good. Nice.
Thank you very much. So everyone should have a wonderful Hanukkah.
Thank you. What's left of it?
What's left of it? Still three rounds to go. Still a good part of Hanukkah left. Oh, there we are. The candles there to Yisrael. Beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Very beautiful. I love your view there, Yisrael. Beautiful view. We're seeing Beit Shemesh.
He's in Beit Shemesh. Okay. Enjoy the rest of Hanukkah.
Have a great week.
Thank you.